welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where today we are concluding our exploration of Richard Donner's Superman. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, and host and voiceover guy here in San Diego, California. And we're back. We're back to wrap up the film. And I'm looking forward to talking about it, Steve, with you and with our special guest,
which is your geek buddy, Michael Vogel, animation writer and executive producer, and one of our best friends, and of course, our resident Superman expert. Welcome back to The Cinephiles.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here once again to wrap up this conversation about still the best Superman movie.
And of course, we couldn't even be talking about this without the incredible support we get on Patreon as well as Apple Podcasts. We literally couldn't make the show without you. And if you want to get some of those benefits like our Cinephile shorts, ad-free versions of the show, or even join the Cinephiles Advisory Board, then you just have to go to patreon.com/thecinephiles or visit Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, and of course, another way that you can support the show is by supporting the people who support us, the great clients and sponsors of the show here, like Hims and True Diagnostic and Washington Red, Red Raspberries, and the other clients and that you hear during the commercial break. So if you want to try out these products using our code so you get a massive discount, does great for us because it lets those sponsors know that they can keep sponsor us here and they will get people to get on board to try their product. So if something grabs your eye grabs your ear and you're curious to try it out, then please remember to use our code. Usually it's Cinephiles there for any of the great products from the sponsors that sponsor us here.
So as we get back into this exploration of Superman, I think it's important to say a little something about normal movie structure. If you took classes in screenwriting, basically, they would talk about these things like the inciting incident and the Act One transition, Act Two, and they're all very complicated. But the big deal is whatever your movie's about, you want to get to what your movie's about as quickly as possible. Mm. That's one of the basic rules of screenwriting. And usually what the movie is about has to do with the plot. So Indiana Jones finds out about the Lost Ark about 15 minutes into the movie. That's when that movie gets going. In most movies, there is a point where you go, oh, now I know what this movie is about. This movie doesn't work that way. In this movie, the movie is really about just following the life of this person. And we don't actually get to a plot until like an hour and a half into the movie, which is in fact where we are. So it's a really strange thing, but I also think I can't say this isn't working.
So question for both of you, because I don't know the answer. And Richard Donner knows what he's doing. He's made lots of movies. I don't think this was like somebody who didn't know how to make a movie and stumbled onto something that just kind of worked. Why do you think, why this movie so different from other movies? It's like the Passover question.
Wow. Well, this movie is different from all other movies because in all other movies, so the reason, here's my opinion about it, is that what those structural things are that are in all these screenwriting books are basically clues on how you keep your audience interested. If the audience doesn't know what they're worried about or what they're tense about or what's going on, they're going to lose their interest. But the idea that it has to be one unified plot, that the main character wants to get this, like the Lost Ark, and in the end they either get it or they don't, is not how all movies work. What they all have to do is keep us interested. And we are 100% interested in Jor-El. And then we're 100% interested in this kid, Clark. And then we're 100% interested in his journey to the Fortress of Solitude. And then we're 100% interested in Clark showing up at the Daily Planet and the first missions. And so even though the plot, like a unified plot, doesn't exist, I think Donner knows how to hold our interest, which is why this movie's working. That's my opinion on it.
Yeah, it's an origin film. And I think what he plays really well is the mystery. Like, he keeps you wondering what he's going to show you. And even if you've read all the comic books, you're wondering what's going to make it into the movie. And if you've only read, like, the serial strips and the newspaper, you're wondering what adventure he's going to go on. What are they going to focus on? And so, and piece by piece, and it kind of works in a meta way because he's introducing Christopher Reeve to the audience. So the mystery is, can he get the job done? Can he really be Superman? Can we care about him? We just had that happen with David Cornsweet to a degree. A lot of people who went to see this movie didn't know who David Cornsweet was. And so we had to see if this guy was really Superman. So it works on so many levels so that by the time we get to the plot, we have firmly established the characters that are the main characters are going to be involved when the plot finally takes off with the time we've spent with Lex Luthor and Gene Hackman, with Christopher Reeve and Superman and Margot Kidder as Lois Lane, and even a little bit Jimmy Olsen. So we've got very clear ideas of who these people are. Now that that's been established, let's get into the last 45 minutes of the movie. And so I totally, or the last, I guess, hour of the movie. And I think it's a fascinating way to do the film. And it, you can't argue that it didn't work, because it did.
What I would point out, though, I mean, there's a different way to... I'm a big fan of adhering to structure. I talk structure all the time. There is a different way to look at the movie. Like, what you are proposing, which is not wrong, is usually what the villain is doing, is kind of the plot. So we are not getting to the villain thing until this point, and we're in the third episode of us talking about this movie. But that's not really what the movie's about. The movie is not about Superman fighting Lex Luthor.
Yeah, no, true.
The movie is about what you get to about 15 minutes into the movie is, oh, hey, babe, I'm going to send my son to Earth. He needs to be a hero. He has to inspire everybody. And then what we watch from that point forward is he lands on Earth. He grows up. He learns from his adopted father. He goes to Metropolis. And we watch this all happening. And what happens with the Lex Luthor stuff is an obstacle to that. Mm-hmm. It is a thing that is like, this is now Superman's biggest obstacle so far. He's had a pretty easy time getting to Metropolis and everything. But what this movie is introducing the audience and saying, hey, this is the story of how this guy became Earth's hero. And the arc of the movie is, oh, is he going to do it? And at about this point in the movie, we're kind of like, he did it. He saved Lois. He went on a great night, got a bunch of bad guys. The paper loves him. Lois Lane interviewed him. Guys, I think he did it. He's Earth's hero. Oh, hold on. There's this other guy that wants to stop him. So we're watching that. And when we get to the end of the movie and he flies off, which we'll get to, like, we're like, oh, he did it. So I think the arc of the movie is actually about Superman becoming Superman.
I hear you. And I totally respect that point of view. But I have never had that thought when I'm watching the movie. For me, it's about, will Superman and Lois end up together? That to me is the plot of the movie. The other stuff, I hear you. You're absolutely right. And it's certainly defensible and it is there in the movie in very big neon lights. But that's just kind of an accepted thing. It was, for me, what I've always come back to in the movie is the Superman and Lois connection. And will they get together? And the way it all goes down. And then what that love of Lois causes him to do, which is always the most fascinating part of the movie for me. Him saving people and cats and all of that stuff, that's a given in a Superman movie. Him trying to figure out how to be with Lois is what carries me through the movie. And that's the thing that sparks him violating the ethics and the things that he's been told by his two fathers in this ultimate act of love, which is arguably something he could be in danger for. And so I like that he was willing to go that far. So that's what fascinates me about that. You're not wrong, Michael. It's just for me personally, as a viewer of the film, I'm more invested in that relationship than I am if he figures out he should be Earth's hero or not.
And even if that's the case, where we are right now is still not really the plot of the movie for you then. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody goes into the movie and goes, I really hope Superman beats Lex Luthor. That's kind of a piece of the bigger puzzle. So I don't know. I just find it really interesting. I could talk structure all day. The getting under the hood of a movie and going like, why does this actually work is one of my favorite things to do. But I know we have other things to talk about.
Yeah, because Lex is not actively trying to stop Superman until these last 45 minutes of the movie. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and frankly, there's no reason to. Lex did nothing, if he didn't send the little radio frequency thing to Superman and hit him with the kryptonite, his whole plan would probably work because Superman doesn't know that it's going on.
Yeah, you're 100% right. He almost goads Superman into the action unnecessarily. That's a great point. Yeah.
But here, this is why I'm glad I brought this up, because both of you made great points. And this is if I was going to point out one thing about it, it's that people think, well, they go like, well, how do I write a movie? And then they're handed a structure and the structure says, this is how you do it. And people tend to go, well, then that's how it has to be. Mm. But what it actually is, it's that the structure tends to work because it keeps people entertained. It's not that the only way to keep people entertained is to follow a specific structure. Right. Is that the point is to keep people entertained. And clearly this movie is doing it. And I always think it's like, as long as I'm in right now and then I'm in the next scene, it doesn't matter how you're doing it. And this is doing it in a very unique way.
It is. I mean, look, I always think of Pulp Fiction when what you're talking exactly. about comes yeah. up, which is do a movie in any order. You can tell a story out of order. You can do whatever. Yeah. But you've got to understand the structure to break the structure and do it differently. And saying it a different way to what you're saying is there are a bunch of people that just are so slavishly, like, you've got to do the math. 1 + 2 = act 1, 2 + 2 = act 2, 3 + 3 = act 3. And usually, and in the case of Superman, this is 100% the case, I don't know that you could sit down and study the structure of this movie and say, this is how three-act structure works. After the fact, because it works, you can go back and say, well, I think that what I do, which is like, oh, at about 15 minutes in, Jor-El says this, and we are tracking this thing. And you could argue that him falling in love with Lois is the final obstacle because he did everything that Jor-El said until this last point in the movie where he is forced to make a choice that is against what Jor-El says. So, like, you can sort of do that, but I don't think that when they wrote it, that's what happened.
Well, particularly because, as we know, they were scrambling to yeah. get anything on paper because they had to go shoot. But let's get into this, which is where we left off. We're going right to now what this actual plot is. And so we have this aerial shot of these trucks with big nuclear missiles coming through the woods. And then we see this self-driving car with a little radar dish and it crashes, and Lex is in a new wig, and Miss Tessmacher is now in a red dress looking gorgeous, unconscious on the street as if she was just in an accident. And out of these army trucks, which just stopped because of this accident, comes Larry Hagman.
What do you want, Mr. Larry Hagman of Dallas fame? You've seen him in a number of things. And what an interesting little cameos he pops up in as an actor and stuff before he got to Dallas.
Well, what's funny to me is, like, he's in a downtime in his career because I Dream of Jeannie is over.
Yeah.
And he's not doing anything. And he was supposed to shoot for like 2 days. And he flies up and it's a rainstorm. So they went into rain delay. He had to stay in Canada for like 3 weeks.
Oh, my God.
Because they couldn't actually get to what he was supposed to shoot. Hey, and we get a joke about all the army guys gathered around this beautiful woman. And what are we going to do?
Well, I suggest a vigorous chest massage. If that doesn't work, mouth to mouth.
Yes, sir.
Sergeant. I won't have one of my men doing anything I wouldn't be prepared to do myself.
Yeah, but sir.
So, it's,
yeah. Go ahead, John.
Let's take this moment and look at it. I know some of our fans recently, a small minority of fans recently, have been upset when I point out some of this stuff. But, hey, deal with it. It's the show. This is an interesting thing to look at now in the tastes of, you know, back then, 1970s. She's in a red dress with a slit down the... So she's meant to be... you know, attract the attention of the military guys. And clearly it works, and she's in the blonde wig. And then there's essentially jokes about how they're going to make out with her. I'm not going to say sexually assault, but certainly take advantage, shall we say, of an unconscious woman by rubbing her chest and kissing her. So this is an innocent joke back in the 70s, but, you know, looking at it now, I would not fault anyone for being a little uncomfortable with what's being portrayed here, because this is a military guy who is using his men to cover for him as a shield while he touches this woman and makes out with her without her consent, and she's unconscious. So it's a bad look, but it's not meant to be a bad look. So it's an interesting thing to consider.
My new thing that I like doing, I do this a lot now, is to watch a joke like this. Whether it's a joke like this in this movie, a joke from Friends, a joke from whatever, a joke that didn't age well, and figure out how you tell the joke today. Because the response that happens a lot of time when the when the minority that gets mad at you for pointing it out goes, well, so we can't make jokes anymore. We can't have fun with this anymore. And I think that that's not true. There's lots of ways to tell jokes and still make them funny, but I often wrestle with, okay, so how would you do this one? It's a fun game that I play.
this one's tough, and I go like, I mean, the fact is, or I'm going to say, I believe that this is a fact, is that at least when I was growing up, the joke of a guy in one way or another taking advantage of a woman, if she's changing, he peeks, you know, guys grabbing asses and shit like that. That was just, when I was a kid, that was just funny.
Yeah,
you know, that was just, guys are going to do that and that's funny. No big deal. No harm done. And I don't think we feel no harm done anymore. you know?
No, and because women have woken us up to this. And look, not all women are going to look at this and be offended by it, and that's totally fair as well. But there are women who have said to us, hey, you're saying it from the male point of view. It's been a predominantly male culture, and predominantly men making these movies. So you didn't take into consideration women's feelings or whatever and how this might look. So look, it's not advocating that you do this. It's an innocent little joke and meant for humor or whatever because of the faces that are made. But yes, I mean, we're more aware of this stuff, and that's a good thing. And as Michael said, you can still do a similar type of joke. You just adjust for the time nowadays, especially in a show, in a film that's supposed to be very wholesome.
Well, the joke, by the way, is exactly the conversation you two are having right now. Like, the joke actually is she's passed out on the ground and she's really sexy. And a guy's like, we should give her mouth to mouth. I'll volunteer. And he's like, whoa, buddy. Yo, you can't just do that. She didn't give her consent. What consent? She's passed out. Well, this is 2025. Oh, so we can't even save people anymore? And you do the whole bit. And while they're doing the bit, Otis and Lex Luthor go behind them. So that is my solution in 2025 to – make this moment from a 1978 movie work. Thank you very much.
Well done, sir. Well done, sir. You've earned your pay for the day.
And both of these films have it. Like, I was watching some of Superman 2 the other day, and the one where he breaks out of the Daily Planet, Richard Donner keeps the, or maybe it was Richard Lester, keeps the camera firmly on one of the female staff members of the Daily Planet so that the dress flies up and you see her panties fully in the middle of the newsroom. So there is this little impishness, sexual impishness in these two films. So it's fascinating.
And with this distraction, Otis runs up, jumps into the back of the thing. He's got numbers on his arm that is entering into some or other, comes back to the car, says he did it. And Lex says,
all right, Otis, listen, it isn't that I don't trust you, but I don't trust you. What'd you do?
And then we find out that, of course, he did it wrong because he only entered three numbers when, in fact, there were four. And we get to watch Lex go nuts.
And Lex says, do you want to see a long arm? I'll show you a long arm. And he just jumps back there, which is insane.
With the car driving.
Yes, but here's the thing, and I want to bring this up because I want to put a pin in this. Miss Tessmacher is clapping as Lex is physically threatening Otis. She is clapping, so I want to put a pin in that for later. So
okay.
Steve, you know I've been losing weight and I've been, kind of looking at food I can make for myself that's going to keep me on this path and keep me healthy. But making food that is fast, flavorful, and still feel special isn't easy. So I turned to my friend, who is a foodie and I would say a burgeoning chef, in Steve Morris. Steve, how can you help me with this, man?
Well, thank you. I take that as quite an honor that I can be your chef de cuisine right now. I mean, the first thing for me is always getting great ingredients, which might mean a trip to the farmer's market, but not everything is in season all the time. And that's why I turn to Red Raspberries from Washington. These berries are grown purposely to be frozen, which means they can be frozen at the peak of freshness by passionate farmers in Washington State. And that's why we know that the quality will absolutely be top-notch when you put them into a recipe. One that I like to do is sometimes when I'm making a steak, I worry that the heaviness of the meat might be too much, so maybe a little bit of acid would help. So I've made a beautiful balsamic and raspberry reduction to drizzle over that perfect ribeye steak. And then for the end of the meal, now I know John's on a diet, but for those of you who aren't, you add a little bit of sugar and some lemon juice to macerate those raspberries, drizzle them over a little vanilla ice cream, maybe some chocolate syrup, some whipped cream. I guarantee it's going to be one of the best ice cream sundaes you've ever had.
That's great, Steve. Well, if you all want to discover new ways to use American frozen red raspberries and get more details on where you can grab a bag of these delicious berries, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. You'll find recipes, health tips, retail locations, and everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. And remember, look for Product of the U.S. on the bag.
Hi, this is Steve. Anyone who listens to The Cinephiles knows how directors need great information in order to make great films. Well, the same is true about our health, but sometimes great info about our bodies can be tough to find. For instance, did you know that your calendar age doesn't always match your biological age? And if that biological age is just a few years older, your risk of heart disease and cancer can go up by as much as 50%. And that's where True Diagnostic comes in. It starts with a simple blood test that you can do at home. No doctor visits or big needles. A few weeks later, you get a report showing your actual biological age, not just for your body as a whole, but individual systems like brain, liver, kidneys, immune systems, hormones, inflammation, and lungs. Now, I've been studying my report, and while some of my systems are actually younger than my 56 years, my immune system and heart are aging faster. Fortunately, True Diagnostic has tailor-made recommendations to fit what my body needs in areas like exercise, diet, supplements, and lifestyle. So, if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use our code CINEPHILES to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use CINEPHILES at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
And so now we got to do the whole thing again. And this time we're hauling a house and crash it, and they stop the missile truck. But this time it is Miss Tessmacher that jumps into the back of the missile thing and reprograms them. And so we've succeeded in reprogramming some nuclear missiles.
And you notice who doesn't change clothes? Miss Tesma. They keep her in the red dress.
Yes.
Meanwhile, those two look like hillbillies out of the Blues Brothers, that group that rides in the RV that they get in trouble with. And so it's fascinating how they don't make her change clothes, but those guys change clothes. And of course, that's for the film, because there are male men who are going to watch it, and they want to find Valerie Perrine.
Oh, there are male men that are going to watch it. I didn't know that the postal service was so into Mrs. Tessmacher.
Listen, she looks great, man.
They got deliveries.
I'd like to deliver my package.
I see your point. Yes,
so this is to the point of what we were talking about, like in the last episode, about this whole section of the movie. All of this feels like it's right out of like Cannonball Run or something. Like this is from a comedic standpoint, this is 100% of the time, and you get why they put it in the movie. This was what people went to the movie to see. These villains doing all of their bits with the costumes and the slapstick. This is not the part that ages in a way that everyone goes, this is the greatest Superman movie ever made. There are a lot of things that we still look at and we're like, no one's beat this. This part has been beat multiple times. I would say that Zack Snyder and James Gunn and even Bryan Singer all beat this stuff.
I'm not going to argue with you. You're 100% right there. Yeah.
We're at Hoover Dam and Jimmy Olsen is there and Lois is driving in a car with a Native American. And just really the funny beat is just her not paying attention to the road and about to crash. And he like points and says, this is where you got to go.
The Custer joke is funny, though, I do think.
At the stupid high price he offered for this worthless piece of desert, I hope it's Custer.
By the way, I just listened to like the 11-part series on Custer and Crazy Horse and the Little Bighorn, which is on the Rest of History podcast, and I highly recommend it.
Wow. 11 parts? And I thought us doing 3 parts on Superman might be too much. Wow.
Dude, the Rest of History is the cinephiles of history shows. They started off doing 1-hour episodes, and now they're in like 17-part deep dives into all this stuff. It is a fantastic podcast, by the way. We're back at the Daily Planet, and we're hearing on the news about these missiles launching, and Clark is looking for Lois.
She's out west looking into a land fraud deal. Sent young Olsen with her on his first assignment. Some unidentified clown out there is buying up thousands of acres of worthless desert at incredible prices.
So this is the plot.
But also Perry White is dressing down Clark a little bit.
He does, yeah.
He's saying like, and Clark thinks, what am I missing, humility? He goes, oh, no, I don't, you got boatloads of humility. I need you to be a little more aggressive, Clark, a little more into things, Clark. And so it's almost meta that Jackie Cooper, the veteran actor, is giving advice to the new actor, Christopher Reeve, about how to be in this business. And you could almost think it's meta, him telling him how to be an actor in this business and how tough and thick-skinned and aggressive he needs to be and all of this kind of stuff. So watching it this time, that kind of occurred to me in a weird way as I was looking at it. So.
Well, and it's also just the classic Superman beat of like, hey, I need you to be a more aggressive, tougher guy when he is the strongest person on the planet.
Yes. But I was thinking about this is that this is something that really gets introduced in this movie because before this, Clark wasn't so wimpy. So you couldn't play this joke. You know, and so I think, you know, this is the idea of like what Christopher Reeve does here opens up this whole other bunch of stuff that we can play with.
I thought about this because you had mentioned it earlier, and I've been doing a rewatch of the Superman animated series, the Bruce Timm series from back in the day, because I love it and it makes me happy.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Bruce Timm clearly had no interest in was wimpy Clark Kent. So I kind of grew up understanding that Clark Kent is, you know, at least in Metropolis, when he's at the Daily Planet and when he's in his disguise, he plays it up to be a little bit more clumsy, a little bit more wimpy. But that's 100% from this movie. You go back and watch the old Max Fleischer cartoons? No. George Reeves series? No. That Superman the Animated series in the 90s? No. Clark is tough. Clark is smart. But Christopher Reeve's whole portrayal here was so specific and so huge that we sort of expect it. Zack Snyder doesn't do it. And then James Gunn does a beat that's less Clark Kent is wimpy and more that him and Lois have like a butting heads, but it is something that we all associate with Clark Kent, but it's really the Christopher Reeve version that nails it. And everyone else does maybe a little bit of it or gives it lip service, but doesn't dive into it as much.
Frankly, there's very little Clark Kent as I'm thinking about it in the James Gunn Superman.
Clark Kent is in one scene in James Gunn Superman.
In the midst of him getting some advice from Perry White, this high-pitched whine hits. And over that high-pitched whine, we hear Luthor's voice.
This is Lex Luthor. Only one thing alive with less than four legs can hear this frequency, Superman. And that's you.
And it's a long monologue, but basically what he's saying is, I'm about to release deadly gas that's going to kill thousands of people. And so Clark walks away from Perry White, and we can see that the high pitch is hurting him. And I actually think the shot, as we watch him through the windows of the Daily Planet, as he goes from window to window, are really kind of cool. Like, it's interesting what's going on.
But a disaster with people in danger, people who need help. Well, I just knew you couldn't resist the chance to sort of pitch in.
And at this moment, Clark is backed up to a window, which he just falls out of and magically transforms into his Superman uniform as he's flying.
He pulls the Linda Carter.
Yeah, totally, totally. And he lands, drills a hole down through the road. And I love all the stuff of Otis going,
I think he's coming, Mr. Luthor.
And he basically crashes through the door. And now Superman looks genuinely pissed, I think, intense in a way we haven't seen him before.
And I wonder if James Gunn was influenced by this in that scene when he breaks through the door to confront Luthor after he's taken Krypto, if there's an element of influence there, because the way Christopher Reeve walks into this room with Lex is a very powerful, commanding presence. You know?
I think they're very similar, but I also think there's probably 1,000 similar moments of Superman, you know, busting through a door and being intense. So,
yeah, it's come up a lot, like the most iconic for a certain generation that I happen to be a part of, is the end of the first few episodes of Superman the Animated Series. And it's Superman just floating outside of LexCorp, outside of Lex's office with arms folded, just glaring at him, I prefer the most. That I like more than this Superman or James Gunn's Superman is the just floating, staring like, I'm going to get you, asshole. But yes, there's a lot of those moments.
My attorney will be in touch with you about the damage to the door. Otis, take the gentleman's cape.
I just love the look that Chris Reeve gives Otis when he goes to take his cape.
Is that how a warped brain like yours gets its kicks? By planning the death of innocent people?
No, by causing the death of innocent people.
And at that moment, the missiles launch.
Fire.
And then Luthor monologues, you know? Yeah. He's like, now that you're here, let me explain my whole plan to you.
Where was I?
California.
California, right.
Oh, the San Andreas Fault, maybe you've heard of it.
Yes, it's the joining together of two land masses. The fault line is unstable and shifting, which is why you get earthquakes in California from time to time.
Now, I grew up right next to the San Andreas Fault. I had my whole childhood hearing about the San Andreas Fault. I had family who survived the 1906 earthquake. Like, this is all normal stuff to me, but to you, East Coasters, this must have been important lessons in tectonics.
So realistic, too. Also, really so is. Realistic. Yeah. So scientifically accurate, this movie.
Everything west of this line is the richest, most expensive real estate in the world. San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco.
Everything on this side of the line is just hundreds and hundreds of miles of worthless desert land, which just so happens to be owned by
Lex Luthor Incorporated.
Which totally isn't true. Apologize to all those people living other places.
It occurs to me that a 500 megaton bomb planted at just a proper point would
destroy most of California. Millions of innocent people would be killed. The West Coast, as we know it, would
fall into the sea.
And then, and John, I know you love this whole thing.
Bye-bye, California. Hello, new West Coast, my West Coast.
Otis lays this new map over California.
Costa del Ex, Lutherville, Marina del Ex, Otisburg.
Let me tell you something. The power of three here is amazing. And I've used this quote since 1978. Whenever I see something I don't like or that doesn't make any sense to me, I'll just go, Otisburg! And it just this reaction always. It's usually like by myself or when I'm hanging out with my significant other through the years. I've definitely just been like, Otisburg! And so, because I love the way he delivers the line. I mean, the way he builds to those three Otisburgs as poor Otis is trying to explain.
Miss Tess Monster, she's got her own place,
Mr. Otisburg.
It's a little bitty place. Otisburg.
And what's interesting about all this is that we know that the missiles have already launched. Mm. This is already happening, but Superman doesn't.
You're a dreamer, Lex Luthor. A sick, twisted dreamer. Your plan couldn't possibly work.
Because he doesn't think this is real. He has the arrogance of, I've got there in time, I can stop anything that's happening.
I'll admit there were a few problems. Adjusting the precise trajectory of the missile, finding the optimum stress point for the fault line itself, which, by the way, is target zero right here.
Ooh. And with his cane, he breaks the glass. And at this moment, we go back to, like, mission control, where they have lost control of the missiles.
Where's the rocket now?
It's going like a bat over the Grand Canyon. South the other one.
The other one? There's two of them?
That's when Superman realizes not only is this really happening, but there are two missiles going out at the same time.
Even you, with your great speed, couldn't stop both of them. While I, on the other hand, could stop them with my detonator.
Superman starts looking for it. He looks with his X-ray vision.
You diseased maniac. Do you really think you could hide it from me by encasing it in lead?
At this point, do you know what's about to happen?
Superman, you got duped. Yep. You got duped.
I like that Lex tricks him by saying, don't open the box. So
yeah,
it's a great.
This is so story. Like Wallace Shawn in The Princess Bride.
Totally.
Like, this is so like, oh, no. No, don't open the box. Oh, that's a terrible idea. I gotcha. Like, it's just so it is like, I will say, even though it is the most dumbed down version of Lex Luthor in a lot of ways, it is still the you are watching him manipulate Superman into doing exactly what he wants. Like, it's very at a basic level, but it is the gist of it is still the essence of brain over brawn, which is what makes Lex Luthor work.
That's kryptonite, Superman. A little souvenir from the old hometown. I've spared no expense to make you feel right at home.
I think Christopher Reeve, who has done such a great job playing the effortless confidence and perfection of Superman, does a great job as the person who's really never experienced pain in his entire life experiencing it for the first time.
Yeah.
I think his reaction to the kryptonite, and particularly when Lex puts it over his neck.
Oh, yeah.
And he kind of crumbles. It's just, it's really upsetting to me to watch.
When it came time to cash in your chips, this old boot, diseased maniac, would be your banker.
I think you know the movie is working if you have that reaction, which you just said, Steve, which is upset. You're upset. Yeah. Like, you're really legitimately upset seeing this happen because Reeve is playing it so well. The utter shock and horror of seeing it and then what it's putting on, like, it's torturing him. Basically, what Luther is doing to him, it's brutal.
You don't even care where the other missile's headed, do you?
Certainly I do. I know exactly where it's headed. Hackensack, New Jersey.
And then he pushes Superman into the pool.
Lex, my mother lives in Hackensack.
And Lex looks at his watch and looks at her and shakes his head and walks away.
Brutal.
Mm.
So there's a weird thing in movies where, in very serious movies, one death can be just tragic. I mean, it's the worst possible thing that can ever happen. And in very comic book movies, we can see things where thousands of people die and we really don't pay very much attention at all. Yeah. I find this movie, like, of course, this movie doesn't really want you to think of the nuclear holocaust potential in Hackensack, New Jersey. But I do think about it sometimes and I'm just kind of like, man, this Lex Luthor is maybe the most sociopathic of any Lex. Like, he doesn't give a fuck about killing hundreds of thousands of people. It is really terrible, the level of cruelty in this plan.
Yeah. And again, just from a screenwriting standpoint, what works great about it is it's a cruel plan. Like, everything you said was true 2 minutes ago.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to send off these rockets. I'm going to destroy the West Coast. I'm going to kill hundreds of millions of people. The end. And in your brain, you go, okay, that is a bad plan. You shouldn't do that. But it's when Miss Tessmacher says, my mom is there,
yes,
that you have now said, well, Lex Luthor's a sociopath. And it's just a smart rule of screenwriting, which is, you know, there's a bunch of people out there that have their ideas for their superhero movie, their sci-fi movie, their post-apocalyptic movie, that the concept of billions of people dying, we're so used to it, and it's such an abstract idea that it doesn't work. But when you have a character who has a loved one who is going to die, all of a sudden it becomes real. We all know it's not real, but it's like emotionally, it's Miss Tessmacher going, my mom lives there, that actually makes us as the audience care more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, by the way, this is a stupid plan. I mean, this is just like, I mean, it's a movie, whatever, but it is what it is. But like, you really think that you're going to get away with blowing away half of California and suddenly you own all the real estate that just happens to be that? Come on. It's a stupid plan. But anyway.
I mean, Steve.
Yeah.
When they were wearing hillbilly disguises
I know.
The nuclear bombs, it was already a stupid plan. This hasn't made it less stupid. Passed stupid a while ago.
Somehow they were able to get a house on the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's all, agreed. Lex is gone. Superman is in the pool with the kryptonite. And Miss Tessmacher is like hiding and watching.
But you can't just stand there and let innocent people, millions of innocent people die.
Maybe.
I do like this whole sequence of this Tessmacher. I like it a lot.
There's just something of all of the silliness of the back half of this movie. This moment, for whatever reason, feels the closest to iconic of all of it. Like it's something about even at his weakest, it is his goodness that is his strength. She's not intimidated by him in this moment. Like, he's beat. But the thing that actually saves him is that he never lies, that he is so trustworthy that even this person who has been working for the villain can come in and be like, I'm going to ask you something. And like, she knows if he says it, it's going to be true. And so again, I think it's like, it's all this silly stuff happening. The whole set is very cool looking. He's like in the water. It's just a cool looking set. But I think it's this concept that even a villain can trust Superman.
Yeah.
That I think is what makes this scene really cool.
I think so too. And I also think on some level we like Miss Tessmacher.
Yeah.
You know, she is the, you know, the beautiful woman on the arm of the horrible supervillain, because she's playing a cliche.
Yes.
But it's a cliche that we kind of can get into. And in particular this moment, because she says,
if I help you, you promise to save my mother first.
And Laura, sir. Jimmy!
Oh, but my mother comes first. If you promise me, I believe you, because you always tell the truth.
And he promises? Then he sinks, like he's gonna die. And she jumps in, drags him to the step. She goes to take the chain off his neck, stops, thinks for a moment, gives a sort of what the hell gesture, and then leans in and kisses it. Then takes it off, tosses it, and he says,
Why did you kiss me first?
I didn't think you'd let me later.
That is a great moment.
Right. And here's the difference, right? Because
she didn't ask for consent.
Well, I was going to say, no, it would clarify the context.
Just saying.
Yes. No, that's fair. And I love that you're saying that.
Neither did Larry Hagman, to be clear.
Larry Hagman is indulging in a lascivious impulse. She's indulging in this thing and is like, she sees him as this good and person. And she even says, how come I can't get the good guys, right? And this is why I wanted to put a pin in this, because in the earlier scene, she is clapping with Lex attacking Otis. And it's like, well, girl, that's why you can't get the good guys, because you enjoy the bad guys still. And until you let go of that, you're never going to get a good guy. So her saying that to Clark in that, to Superman in that moment, is her, like, in her own way, although she's not doing it from an altruistic place to save millions of people or thousands of people. She's doing it to save her mom. But, like, she's in that place where she is understanding that what Lex is doing is wrong. And finally, right, throughout the whole movie, she hasn't quite done that. But in this moment, she does. And it's not an accident that they've put her in almost an all-white dress, almost a virginal type of thing. Whereas before, when you saw her being evil, she was in the red dress, right? And so it's like there's a difference in their approach and how they want this done. And Valerie Perrine just delivers a very sweet performance in this section of the movie, the peeking out, the making him promise, the jumping in, and then the way she holds him as if she's caring for him. I think it's a very sweet thing, which is why I think the scene works, you know?
That's all true. I would just point out that if this was a Wonder Woman movie made in the 70s, and Wonder Woman was weak, and the male sidekick to the villain did the exact same thing as Miss Tessmacher, no matter how sweet it was, we would be sitting here right now going, whoa, 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 you can't do that today. I'm not saying that this is a horrible moment or that it doesn't work, because I agree with I think it's a great moment. I love it. But I do think it is funny. That whole – and it, look, it's the power dynamics of misogyny. There's a whole deeper discussion to go into. But I do think it's funny that your very heartfelt description of this lovely moment with her in the white dress cradling him and taking care of him and everything you said is all true.
Right.
But it is funny that it if the shoe was on the male foot, it would be different.
For me, it wouldn't, because it's about context. If this was, you know, like kind of a weak man, and this is the situation where he does this thing and he's like in awe of it, and she essentially puts him in his place, then I think you can make this, like you said, how do we do a 2025 joke? How do we do this moment in reverse in 2025? And I think there is a way to do it where she smiles but makes it very clear to him that it's not going to happen, because Clark makes it very clear to her, or Superman rather, makes it very clear to her that it's not going to happen between them, you know? But he still caresses her face. And then he goes, okay, I got to go, you know? And so there's a way in context, right? Whereas Larry Hagman, that's lascivious.
Yeah.
I think if she had like taken advantage of him being in kryptonite and had forced herself on him, then yeah, that would be the same thing. So I think the context is where it matters.
That's a different movie, guys.
Yes.
It didn't really even occur to me, the connection between the Larry Hagman moment and this moment. And it should have, and I'm really glad it came up, because I actually think, I'm trying to think, it's hard to say it in just the right way with all of this stuff, but like, the reason that we're more sensitive about this stuff is that people were hurt, people were abused, people were in situations where they didn't have power, and it's really important that that stuff has come out. Mm-hmm. But it's also the reality, and I think this is what we butt up against, is that there are a lot of gray areas in this stuff.
Oh, sure.
Where the reason we're putting rules is that someone can think they're a gray area and not realizing they're really hurting somebody.
Yeah.
But the fact is that these things are a little bit different situationally, you know? And so it's a little bit in this particular case, watching what her experience of this moment was and watching Superman's reaction to it, I go, this all seemed okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's a timid kiss. It's not a, let me throw my tongue down your throat kiss, which is what Larry Hagman was doing.
But she also was saying that he was hot earlier in his description. He's 6'4", he's 200, blah, 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 he never lied. Like, she is turned on by the guy.
Sure.
And so you could easily translate it into something that wasn't so cool.
Sure.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Anyway, Superman leaves. He's after the missiles. And I actually think they've been working so hard on the flying, I really think they saved some of the best stuff for now, because him flying up against that missile. And again, we're in that thing where Christopher Reeve's like in a box with a camera and a front screen projector on gimbals, both spinning at both times. But the stuff of him chasing after that missile, catching it, and then pushing it so it flies off in the wrong direction, I think is really cool.
Yeah.
And now we, while listening to Give a Little by Supertramp, we see Lois pulling into a gas station. The nuclear bomb hits. Jimmy sees a mushroom cloud. I mean, this is all really scary stuff. And then we're, well, agreed. Okay.
I mean,
when I was 10, this was scary stuff. Particularly when we're going to get to the miniature town that the flood goes through. I mean, yeah. It's like, it gets real bad. But so the,
I don't know if this is on purpose, but it feels like a little bit of foreshadowing. When she pulls up into the gas station, and the line from the song you hear is, give a little bit of my life for you.
Mm.
And so I don't, sure. I have to think that's not an accident from the great Richard Donner, and that that's the line, because they're foreshadowing that she's going to die and that Clark is going to Superman's going to violate his things to bring her life back, you know? And so I thought there's a little bit of foreshadowing that I thought was very cleverly done. And you only catch it if you're really, really watching it.
Plus, who doesn't like Supertramp?
Exactly. I mean, come on. Supertramp's amazing.
So the bomb is hit. The gas station blows up. Lois drives away with telephone poles falling everywhere. Superman goes down under the ground. We cut to the Golden Gate Bridge, which, by the way, this version of the Golden Gate Bridge was built at Pinewood Studios and is 70 feet long.
Oh, wow.
That is a long miniature. That is a big miniature. Cables are collapsing. The bus goes into the railings halfway off the bridge. Superman's underground. Maybe it's just because I remember this when I was a kid. When I was a kid, the shot of him lifting up the San Andreas Fault was just so cool. And looking at it now, you know, it is what it is. But it meant a lot to me as a kid.
I like him flying through the magma or whatever that is. I kind of do enjoy that. And yeah, the cheesiness of the Earth coming back up. Sure. But you forgive it at this point. I think the magma flying is damn cool, you know.
And now we're back at the bridge and the bus is about to go over. Kids are screaming, and there is Superman, who shows up as the theme hits, puts the bus back on the bridge. He does the old lay down on the railroad tracks to become one of the rail. I always go like, that doesn't seem like that would work, but the train goes right over him. It's all good. Jimmy Olsen's at Hoover Dam, which starts collapsing, and he starts taking pictures, which I'm like, damn, good job on you. I would run the hell away if I'm on this thing.
Way to go, Jimmy.
But then he does fall. Superman saves him.
You're safe here, son.
That's okay. Miss Lane will be driving by any minute.
Which is totally not what he's going to say when he shows up later on in the movie.
Yeah.
And now Lois is driving, and a chasm basically opens up in the road, and her car falls into it. And this is where we need to talk. Before we get to what's about to happen, we have to talk about how we got here. So we're going to go way back to how this whole thing started, which is the decision by the Salkins, the producers, to make two movies at once. Mm. So this whole time, Richard Donner has been shooting both Superman 1 and Superman 2. And if you remember, the studio did this as negative pickup, which means they said, we're not going to give you any money, but we will give you money for the movie when you're done with it to release it. Mm. Well, they didn't say they would give them money for two movies. So as this is going along and they saw the Krypton stuff, they got happier and they said, okay, we're going to handle more regions. We're going to give you more money for the one movie. But they're also going way over budget and way over schedule to make the two movies. And they've got about 75% of both films done. And at this point, the relationship between the Salkins and Donner is gone. It's basically, will you tell the director, Mr. Donner, that we will not do this? Well, will you tell my producers? Like, that's, they're not speaking to each other. It's gotten really, really bad. Movie's way over budget. And again, Warner Brothers is saying, yes, we're going to give you more money for movie one, but not movie two. And so what they finally decide is they're like, look, we got to get to the end of this thing so we can get paid by Warner Brothers. So they shut down. Let's only focus on finishing movie one. We're not going to shoot anything that's shooting movie two. We're not going to do right now. We're just going to focus on movie one. And they're really worried about the budget. And there's this guy who's worked with them on the Musketeer movies, Richard Lester, who is a well-known director. And they said, hey, can you come help out as a producer? So they start putting him on the set basically to act as a go-between between them and Richard Donner, who they're not speaking to. So, A, how do you feel as Richard Donner when your producers put a well-known director on your set?
I think that's a dick move, honestly. It's
terrible.
Yeah, it's the same thing with in sports when they hire a former head coach to be the assistant head coach for the head coach who's kind of been not had some good results the last couple of years. It's essentially them saying to you, you better step up or this guy's going to take your job. And so having them be on there, and this is sometimes where I get mad at producers because they pull this kind of crap because sometimes they can be soulless a-holes. And they do this stuff to mess with creatives. Never mind that the creatives doing a good job is what puts money in their pockets. But they do these moves sometimes, and it's so petty and childish. And a lot of times Hollywood is just a high school, man. And this is a high school petty-ass move, you know?
Counterpoint.
Okay.
Now, in this case, yes, we all love Richard Donner, and we all believe that what Richard Donner was doing was the better thing because hindsight is 20/20.
Sure.
Yes, sometimes producers are assholes. And the director is creatively doing something amazing. But the reason that producers exist is because sometimes the director is going off the rails.
100%.
And the producer's like, fuck, I got to get in front of this. Like, yeah. I do think there's this weird about, like, we don't always hear, like, we always hear the stories about the put upon brilliant director who had this vision and the vision wasn't met. But there are just as many stories of, holy shit, this director slash showrunner slash whoever is completely off the rails and not listening to anybody. Somebody needs to get in there and be an adult in the room so that we can get this thing done on time.
Yeah.
And I don't, and you know, and like, I don't know what Donner was like on set. And again, hindsight being 20/20, I prefer the Donner cut. I like what Richard Donner was doing. I don't think we would have the Superman movie that we're talking about today without him, but I don't think it's always producers, evil, creative, put upon genius, if only I could get my vision out there.
No, you're correct. That's why I said sometimes. And the other element is, to prove Michael's point, the first job I ever had coming out here was working on Wind Talkers for John Woo. And the only reason I got the job being an extra on that set was because John Woo was pissing away money in Hawaii shooting the first 3-4 months of that movie. And the studio got so upset about how much money he was spending on this film that they pulled the entire production back to Los Angeles so they could put a guy on set to monitor him. And I watched it as an extra who was on set almost every day. I watched this older gray-haired dude with a kind of a black hat cap who walked around in this members-only leather jacket and arms folded and would tell John Woo, all right, you've done 4 takes. We're moving on. So I witnessed it. So you do make a good point, Michael. Sometimes it goes one way, sometimes it goes the other. So.
Well, and I would say more likely it's all in the middle. Like there are things that Donner is doing that are creative, important, and part of his vision that they're trying to shut him down. And sometimes he's not always spending money efficiently. Like I will say, for anyone who has actually spent their own money to try to do something, and John obviously is the person who runs your own channel. You know what if you had someone who was doing a show for you and they were spending twice as much money on their show that you spent on your show and they weren't bringing in as many views, you would be fucking pissed off.
I'd give it a few months to see what happened, but then yes, we would have conversations. 100%.
This is why I prefer using other people's money.
Other people's money is the way to do it. I just haven't always been able to do it that way. but the thing is, and the other thing is, I don't know, Michael, if you've had to fire someone at the last minute in one of your projects, but what the problem with doing that is that you're going, if I fire someone in the middle of the day of this shoot, I need someone to come in and take over and they're not going to know anything. Like if you fire someone like your DP or your AD, someone who's involved in tons of stuff, you need someone up to speed. Well, if you publicly put another director on your set at all times, well, the second you decide to fire Richard Donner, Richard Lester can step in.
Which is clearly what the plan was.
Yeah.
So now we have movie 2 in flux. Richard Lester's there. We're doing both of them at once. And they realize, because this was the end of the movie, we have just, what I just got to, before Lois's car goes into the ground, is the end of the movie. Clark pushes up that fault line, saves a bunch of people in California, stops what's happening. Hooray, he won. And everyone is looking at it and going, this just isn't enough. Way back at the beginning of the process, Mario Puzo, the original screenwriter, pitched to DC Comics and the rest of the team, I think we should kill Lois Lane. And everyone went, you can't kill Lois Lane. Are you crazy? You can't kill Lois Lane. And he's like, this is the guy who wrote The Godfather. He's like, I killed Sonny. I can kill whoever I want. And they argued about it and they said they couldn't do it. And now we're at the end. We've shut down movie two. Richard Lester's on the set. The end of movie two is a time travel ending where he changes history because of what Zod and everyone else was doing. And they suddenly go, wait a minute, what if we do kill Lois Lane like Mario Puzo suggested, but bring her back using the ending for movie two? And by the way, by the time they are shooting this at this moment, they have 11 different crews shooting simultaneously at three countries.
Wow.
This is a hugely complicated production when they're trying to figure this out.
Fascinating. So,
but the best part is once you filmed all the destruction, you can just run it backwards and you say, like, you know, you're like, yep, I'm
good.
You
already did it.
Save money, guys. So, run it in reverse.
So killing Lois Lane in a Superman movie.
Yep.
Maybe not a bad thing sometimes. Go ahead. Go ahead, Steve. Go ahead.
I don't even know what that refers to.
I don't even know what that clearing of your throat was in reference to.
Zack Snyder's story, which was going to kill Lois Lane. Everybody lost their minds on Twitter about him wanting to kill Lois Lane. And is that?
I didn't know that he wanted to kill Lois Lane.
Oh, I thought we just lost our minds because Batman versus Superman was horrible.
That was bad. I've always said that. Don't try to claim like I haven't.
So Lois's cart is stalled. She's on the road. She sees rocks crumbling down the mountains. This chasm comes towards her. She screams. The car flies in. And I will just say, what they did to Margot Kidder in this car. This is real. I mean, actors have to deal with a lot of stuff. This one in particular, she's in a tiny space and they just dropped dirt on her for several days.
What?
Lots. And she said several days in this set trying to get all these shots. This is really brutal. And then we get, as I mentioned before, the water is coming down towards this little town from the broken dam, and Superman creates a landslide to create a dam. And this is just, look at all the miniatures.
I call this the Godzilla section of the movie because it is absolutely all these so very obvious miniatures. Yeah.
He's just finishing up. He's very happy with himself. And the whole time as he's been doing this, we've been intercutting to Lois in the car, getting crushed, slowly dying. It's really upsetting and scary, by the way.
It is. By the way, of all the stuff that you were like, this is upsetting, this is scary, and I'm like, is it? This actually is. Like, the her face and the dirt and everything, like, it is, you can tell that that's real dirt and that she's really in that, and it is uncomfortable if you are even a little bit claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And then Clark hears her, and we hear the love theme, and he flies super fast. And by the way, this is another technique for how to do the flying. And this one is using a version of what is called a Zolli. So a Zolli is the thing that's in very famously in Vertigo and Jaws, the Vertigo effect, which is you have a camera on a dolly and you are zooming in while you dolly out, or you dolly in while you zoom out, so that the distance, the face, stays in exactly the same spot, but everything distorts, right?
We now just call it the severance elevator move.
Exactly. So here's a variation on it, is that Christopher Reeve is in front of a front projector, and they zoom on his face in sync with the perspective change, with a camera move on the image behind him on the front projector. So they're syncing, instead of a zoom with a dolly, they're syncing a zoom with something that has already been filmed on the projection. It's just crazy. And if you look at these shots, you can totally see it. And I think it's a really, really cool effect. And they called this Zoptics. So Zoptics is Superman's size changes, but the image remains the same size by zooming in and out on Superman in front of the projection. I don't know if that makes sense, but if you watch some of these shots, you will totally see it. He gets to the car, pulls it out, looks down, sees dead Lois. And I think Christopher Reeve is great with the way he handles all this. The anger as he rips the door off, touches her face. I kind of go like, hey, maybe some first aid might have been a good call here, but she's clearly already dead.
Why don't you use your super breath there, Soups?
Yeah, come on, man. I mean, Larry Hagman was willing to do some chest compressions and mouth to mouth. And we hear the love theme. I think the performance in all of this is really beautiful. I love the way he holds her and touches her face and then gently lays her down on the ground. Here's a bit of film production I didn't know. So the Lois in the car with dirt falling on her, that was shot at Pinewood in London. This exterior shot in New Mexico. The dirt does not match. So they had to fly in bags of dirt from London to have it match the dirt in New Mexico. And when they opened it up and the dirt hit, a whole bunch of bugs started crawling out of the London dirt. So we sort of invaded the New Mexico, you know, biosphere with some London bugs.
Wow. I will. Yeah. But to your point, not about the bugs, but to your point about Christopher Reeve, this is what's about to happen. We'll talk about, and it's kind of silly and over the top, but it is his reaction to seeing Lois dead that does sell this moment.
100%.
What he's doing here is like just a masterclass in he's been flying around, stop saving miniatures from being destroyed, like all the cheesy stuff around this. But this moment is so real that you just go, okay, I'm in. I'm back in. And it is amazing. I didn't know what you had just said about this not originally being the end. I mean, if you hadn't had this, like the whole point of the end of a Superman movie is getting to a point where Superman, no matter how super he is, can't do something. That's true in James Gunn's Superman. It's true in Zack Snyder's Superman coming up against Zod and the Kryptonians. And here, if you don't have this, if Gene Hackman's just like, I did this thing, haha, you can't stop me.
Right.
And then he stops him. That's not the end of a movie. Right. But going, I saved Miss Tessmacher's mom first because I promised I would. I did everything. I came so close to actually beating Lex Luthor, except I couldn't save the one person that's the most important to me. His solution, we'll talk about, but that is what makes the ending of this movie work.
Yes, you're 100% right. And it's quizzical too, though, isn't it? Because the whole thing of him wanting to get out of that pool was to save Lois and Jimmy. Yet he gets distracted enough by everything that he's doing that he forgets about Lois at a critical time. And when he remembers her, it's too late. By the normal timeline, it's too late.
I wouldn't say that he forgets about Lois.
Well, I would tell you as an actor, when he stand there with hands on his hips and he's looking at his handiwork and how he stopped the water, his face is like almost like a good job, kid, to himself.
Yeah, he's not thinking about Lois at that moment.
Lois at all. And so that when his face changes.
All right, that's a good point.
Because he remembers Lois. And in that moment, he's like, oh shit, Lois. Boom. And
I retract my former statement.
It's fine. That's fine.
I mean, I think he's dealing with, you know, whatever the biggest problem is in front of him at that moment. Right. And Lois, he doesn't see. I totally agree because I think if I had had a student presenting me the time travel thing at the end of their movie, I would have said, don't do that. And frankly, if I had a student, and I've said this many times, who has either the primal scream or the big, no, I'd say, don't put that in your movie. It almost never works. It's really hard to do. It's super cheesy. That being said, what Christopher Reeve does in this moment, 100% works. It is so good, I think.
It is the moment of the movie for him as an actor, in my opinion. Yes, the sweet moments with him and Lois in the air and all this really cool and great and touching. The way he holds her head and the way he softly kisses her, I think, after he knows she's dead or the rage from deep in his body, because it is the rage of the loss of his father. It is the rage of, you know, and they play that clip of him in the voiceover where, you know, he says all that power and I couldn't save him. His scream is an amazing scream. And I have never watched that movie and not marveled at the feeling I feel when I hear this primal scream of pain and rage and anger and frustration in that moment. It's so believable and it's so essential to his performance as a circle, like an entirely full performance. You need this element of Superman to be here as well. And it's so well done.
I totally agree. I think it's an amazing moment. And then he flies straight up. And by the way, this is what we were just talking about. If you want to see a good example of Zoptics, this shot of him flying up is a perfect one to see where they're doing this zoom on his face and how that works.
Yeah.
Then he flies up into orbit, and they do such a good job of making us hear the key lines.
It is forbidden for you to interfere in human business.
One thing I do know, son, and that is you are here for a reason.
It is forbidden. All those things I can do, all those powers, and I couldn't even save him.
Those three lines together, I think, create a perfect internal conflict. They externalize perfectly an internal conflict. Even though the not interfering with human history is a little bit weird and it's like, well, what is actually, why did he say that? But it still, I think, really does work in this moment.
Well, so here's a question I have. Like, I am, like, if this is, at this point in the production, they were like, shit, let's do something different. Let's kill Lois Lane and do the time travel thing.
Yes.
Did they go back and record Marlon Brando's don't fuck, don't fuck with history line doesn't exist without this ending.
I think
so, and this is a good example of, like, you know, this often happens with screenplays. You do something to the ending and you go, okay, this is the better ending, but holy shit, we need to plant this idea somewhere in act one. And so you go find the place that you're going to plant the idea. Like, this movie goes on, and I don't think that Jor-El even ever says, whatever you do, don't mess with their history. That's forbidden. If you're not going to get to the end of your movie. Now, maybe they recorded it because that was originally the plan of the end of two, and he was going to fuck with history because of
That's
Zod.
Possible.
But then they were like, okay, well, we're going to use it here. But it's an interesting, but regardless, that line was there. And like that, the whole don't fuck with history thing. Yeah. I'm just curious as to how it all went about now.
I genuinely looked for an answer to this question. I couldn't find it. So my assumption is that it was recorded as ADR when they were in post, but I don't know the answer. And it is, as you said, possible that you were going to use it for the second movie.
Yeah, I feel because Christopher Reeve says that Brando was supposed to be in the second movie. I recently watched an interview from the past with him, and he said Marlon was supposed to be in the second movie. But because of legal and contractual issues, he did not appear in the second movie. So my assumption, Steve, I'm with you. I think they shot a bunch of stuff with Marlon just to get their $3 million worth or whatever in like the 2-week time frame they had. And they used what they needed to use for this movie. And then for the ending, they went and found this one line of dialogue that they had already pre-recorded and just put it up there.
They definitely shot stuff. There's stuff where Lara, Kal-El's mom, shows up in Superman 2.
Yes.
And they originally shot that stuff with Brando. So that was some of the stuff he was supposed to do. And I'm not, because we're not doing an episode on Superman 2 at this moment, I'm not entirely up on how all those things happen. It would be an interesting thing to find out.
Yeah.
But needless to say, he ignores these warnings, flies counterclockwise around the Earth. I think that's the secret. And the Earth then starts spinning backwards. And this is how they visualize going time. And the big thing to me is, I'm like, what exactly did he do? Like, normally on a time travel movie, like in Endgame, you go back in time and you do things different from what happened before that gets different results. But all we see Superman do is he goes back in time and then it starts going forward, except Lois is for some reason not dead. And I really don't understand why.
I mean, look, that is the thing about this moment, which it's like all vibes, no logic. Like, the Earth going counterclockwise is the dumbest thing I ever heard. Like, it's just like, that is I don't know what that is. But look, in the Silver Age of comics, Flash had a cosmic treadmill that he used to time travel. Like, time travel has been, you know, like in Star Trek 4, they whip around the sun and they're back in the 80s. Like, you know, you just and went through some milky white special effects. Like, you just, okay, I'm going to give it to them. But you are right. It wasn't I'm going to go back in time and change this one thing.
Right.
He just sort of goes back so that it doesn't happen. And then
Except everything happened. The bomb still hit, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everything happened except Lois didn't fall in that hole.
You see everything go backwards in the cheesy kind of way that they did back then with things just going in reverse. And he went all the way to the point that Yeah, the bomb. But the thing is, all he did was move the Earth on its axis, right? Which would have fucked up other planets, by the way. But we're not thinking about that in the galaxy. Well,
a lot of things would happen if the Earth started to spin in the other direction, John. It's like
I would fall off.
Fucking up the other planets is the least of my concerns if the Earth starts spinning in the other direction.
One of those planets falls out of orbit, hits us. I think that's a big concern. But yes, you're right. There's a lot of things.
But it is. I mean, like, when you watch the movie, again, this is one of those weird emotion versus logic. And to be fair to this movie in the way that we all hold it up in esteem, this wouldn't fly today. Geeks today need their logic to logic while they want their emotion to emotion.
I mean, there's still ridiculous things in movies.
There are, but like you – look – And this is why Geek Twitter exists, because everyone has their bar. Some people think what happens at the end of Flash or Quantumania or Multiverse of Matt, like, take your pick, and they go, this makes perfect sense. And other people are like, the fuck it does, and everybody argues about it. Nobody can argue that what happens here makes a lick of sense, but we all talk about this movie like we love it so much, and it's because regardless of any – what the fuck just happened did I see that we all go through, Superman was met with an obstacle that he could not or was not allowed to surpass, overcome. And he overcame it anyway. And that is really what Superman is all about. Like, every version of Superman that exists in different ways. Bryan Singer was like, what if Lois Lane fell in love with James Marsden and had a baby and Superman was not the dad, but oh wait, no, Superman was the dad. What do you do with that? Zack Snyder wanted to deal with the Zod of it all and then the doomsday of it all. And Superman died and he fucking came back. And James Gunn, a little bit more contained, but it kind of does the same thing that Donner does, which is Donner goes, hey, there's two missiles. You can't be in both places. Right. And James Gunn said, okay, well, there's Barovia and we split open Metropolis and you can't be in both places. And each one of them deals with how did Superman overcome this? And the ones that do the better job, in my opinion, are Superman's love, Superman's kindness, Superman's inspiration does it. Superman loves Lois Lane so much that he brings her back to life. How he does it is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life and it makes no sense. But all I come away with is Superman loved Lois Lane so much that he did it. That's all that really matters.
100%. And if the film didn't work, this would stick out like a sore thumb. But because the film works, you forgive it because you're like, F it, I still get my happy ending. Yeah. And it still works. It still resonates. And I love that, you know, Lois is unaware of the sacrifice that Superman has made, which makes the scene when he returns back to her even more fantastic.
Yes. In my opinion.
There is a wonderful diagram created by Walter Murch, one of the great editors of all time, who edited Apocalypse Now and all sorts of amazing films. And what it is it's basically like a pie chart that says, this is how important each thing is when you make a cut, when you make an edit. And the thing that's interesting about this chart and why I bring it up is that according to Walter Murch, 51% of the reason you make a cut is emotional. And I think the next biggest one is maybe 30%, which is storytelling and informational, is that he says if the cut works emotionally, it works. And I think that's basically true of filmmaking. What we were saying before this moment was how incredibly well Christopher Reeve's emotional reaction to Lois's death works. Yeah. If that works, yes, this silly time travel thing doesn't really make it sense, but the emotional connection we have to the moment carry us over the lack of logical thing, because we're in emotionally.
Yep.
That's what's important. Yeah. Speaking of which, he's turned back time. We're back with Lois, whose car has not gone into the chasm for some
reason. Lois, who did not die.
Who did not die. She's trying to start her car. I love the choice that we see Superman in the reflection or through the window first. I think it's so great. And Christopher Reeve, again, plays it so well of, I literally just saw you dead, and now I have to pretend I didn't see that.
Hi. Don't bother, I think it's dead.
And then Lois goes off on a Lois rant.
This is great.
The problem with Men of Steel, there's never one around when you want one. Do you know what happened to me while you were off flying around? I was almost in an earthquake. I had this gas station blow up beside my car. There's telephone poles falling all over the road. I'm almost killed, and that topped the whole thing off. This stupid car runs out of gas.
I'm sorry about that, Lois. But I've been kind of busy for a while.
And then it's the classic moment. It's Han Solo and Leia. They're getting a little bit closer. This is obviously going to be the moment they kiss. And there is Jimmy Olsen.
Thanks a lot, Superman. You put me on a road in the middle of nowhere during an earthquake. No food, no water, snakes everywhere. I had no idea if you were coming back. I mean, were you going to come back or no?
Again, I want to point out the last thing we heard him say, which in my time estimate is only like 10, 20 minutes ago.
That's okay. Miss Lane will be driving by any minute.
I mean, one could argue, and again, this would be complete headcanon, that what Superman really did was he... No, it doesn't even make sense because it's not like he stops Lois's car. Never mind. It just doesn't make sense.
If you're going to go back in time, just stop the second missile.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
And then none of this happens.
Because he takes off to handle all this stuff that's going to happen when they miss. Good point.
Well, but like, okay, like if, just for 2 seconds, if this was a logical time travel movie, he would go back in time.
Which, by the way, no such thing as a logical time travel movie. Now go on with your point.
Back to the Future is a logical time travel movie. It makes perfect sense.
Why are images of themselves in the photographs slowly fading away?
That's quantum physics, Steve.
Okay. Go on with your little point. No, it doesn't make logical sense.
If he did go back in time and he managed to just rewind everything to get to the point, either you go back so far back in time that you break Lex Luthor's hand before he even presses the button, which is really the smartest thing to do. But if you don't do that, you still have the same amount of time and all of the same things are about to happen. You just know you have to be faster. So if he's going to do that, he has to go and do all the things he did, grab Jimmy, don't even talk to him, speed, and then catch Lois right before the thing happens. And she's like, you got me, who's got you? And that's how you really would have done it. And that would have made more sense. But again, if I could choose, as stupid as this ending is, him sort of just showing up and casually talking to her and her having zero idea of what he just went through and going on a Lois Lane, let me tell you how bad my day was, is more enjoyable.
You got me picturing the Groundhog Day version of this where he keeps going back in time repeatedly trying to get everything done.
I didn't do it. That's the ending of Ezra Miller's Flash movie.
Oh, right. Oh. Yeah, yeah.
That is literally what he does.
And people hated that ending.
So. I blocked that whole movie. I literally have blocked that whole movie out. I honestly can't remember any of it.
Listen, there's something I have to do. I'll see you later.
Flies away.
Ah, golly, Miss Lane. It's too bad Mr. Kent wasn't here to see all this.
Yeah, poor Clark. He's never around once. Clark, wait a minute.
What?
Lois Lane, that is the silliest idea you've
ever. There's such a great scene. Also, like you were saying in the, I think the first part, Steve, or maybe the most recent part, where you were saying it's really based on a screwball comedy type of thing. And this is a great screwball comedy last moment between them, right? Like for this particular section of the movie. And it's great because she's going off about her day. And the second he says, well, it's a bit busy, Lois, she stops and she realizes what she's doing, right? And her face completely changes. And her face change is what makes us fall in love with Margot Kidder as Lois.
Yeah.
These little moments are what make us fall in love with her when she realizes that she's, you know, kind of gotten a bit too self-involved. But then that sweet little angel smile comes on her face and you're like, oh, I forgive her for everything. And it mirrors how Christopher Reeve is looking at her, which is, as you said, Steve, a great acting moment in Michael as well. Like you see how much love he genuinely has for her. So when she has those moments, you forgive them too, because you're so you're such a fan of the love that is there between them, or at least on his side.
Well, Superman is a person who is incredibly in control.
Yes.
And naturally he's attracted to someone who can't be controlled and can't control herself on some level.
Let me tell you something, Miss Lane. I think he really cares about you.
Clark, of course he does.
No, not Clark.
Oh, well,
Superman cares about everybody, Jimmy.
And then the follow-up to that is great, too, because she says...
But who knows, someday, you know, if he's lucky.
Lois Lane, ladies and gentlemen.
It's great. And then the I'll just call it the coda of Superman flying into the prison, carrying Lex and Otis.
I think these two men should be safe here with you now so they can get a fair trial.
I think there's certain elements, and obviously Lex and Otis and Miss Tessmacher are classics of them, which is just we're doing the old comic book stuff. And this is the old comic book stuff. We're delivering the bad guy to the prison without a trial, an arrest warrant, no evidence, anything else. It's just, here's the bad guy. Thanks.
Who is it, Superman?
And Lex Luthor reaches up, pulls off his wig, revealing that he's been bald all along, and says,
Lex Luthor, the greatest criminal mind of our time.
Of our time?
I hereby serve notice.
He's serving notice to you.
That these walls.
That these walls here.
Will you shut up, please? What? You.
All right, take them away.
I do love, like, why did he take his hair off?
The reason he took his hair off is because we all know Lex Luthor is bald, and we had to prove the point at least one moment. And yes, he is wearing a bald cap. He did never did shave.
Obviously. But yeah, I do think it's like, again, like there's just like there's a world where you came up with a reason why he had to do it. Just makes me laugh. And I love the moment. It's just pure Gene Hackman goodness. Mm-hmm. I love the moment, but I'm just like, what the hell is he doing?
I love the warden getting dramatic too. America is the world is now safe again, Superman. Thank you.
It's all the just full-on old-school comic book stuff.
No, sir. Don't thank me, Warden. We're all part of the same team. Night.
And I think the final flying shots of him over the Earth as the sun rises and in the distance, and then he flies towards the camera and the music is playing, and then he flies into that close-up and looks and smiles at camera before flying away. It's great. I think they did it.
It's a great ending.
Principal photography wraps, and then Christopher Reeve stayed on for, this is what I'm told. It doesn't sound believable to me, but what I read is that he stayed on for close to a year working on flying shots.
Wow.
That just seems crazy to me, close to a year, but whatever it is, he worked a long time.
I mean, listen, given the fact that every single flying shot that we've been through in this movie, you've explained to us how they've done it, and almost all of them are different from the others. I don't not buy it.
Yeah.
And also because, you know, as we were saying, I think in last week's episode, you know, we do live in a world where we bitch about visual effects every single movie. Like, oh, that looked fake. Oh, they didn't do that. But visual effects, you can do anything now. Like back then, they had to figure it out. And some things you watch like Krull. Or some movies, and you're like, yeah, that did not hold up. But you watch the original Star Wars, you watch this movie, and even though you can see that it's a special effect, it works. Like it affects you emotionally. It feels real. And so I believe that they spent that much time making sure they got it right.
I mean, their tagline was "You'll believe a man can fly," so they got to get that right, for God's sakes.
Yeah, and by the way. I think they did.
Yeah.
I think the flying, they definitely nailed. There's, you know, I think it was obviously really hard. And I really wonder, just in terms of special effects, how special effects people feel this moved the ball forward. Mm. You know, because I think everyone always talks about this right when Star Wars is being made. Star Wars is obviously the huge behemoth of special effects at this time, but maybe Superman's in there too.
Yeah.
Goes in a post. The editor is Stuart Baird, who has worked with Donner a lot, including on The Omen. He worked on Lady Hawk. He worked on Lethal Weapon. He also did Gorillas in the Mist. He did Die Hard, a movie, John, this editor did that I know you have strong feelings for, which is The Last Boy Scout.
Oh, yes.
It sounds like he and Donner had huge knockdown, dragout, screaming fights where they would vow never to work together again. Stuart Baird quit multiple times, and they continued to work together over and over again on many, many movies, and apparently had a great relationship.
Oh, those kids.
It was supposed to be released in the summer, but they missed their summer release. They were so rushed finishing this movie that there weren't any test screenings. The movie went straight from the mixing stage to the premiere.
Wait, we got to stop there. Can you imagine all of this for a film coming out in 2025. The YouTube sphere would be going crazy. What? There's no test screenings? That can't be good. They moved the release date? They spent a year trying to do the flying shots? This movie's going to suck. I'm telling you right now. They're in danger. They're in danger. This is exactly what the narrative would be all over YouTube. It's fascinating. Well,
this week is on the hot mic.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Well, Superman is in trouble before it even makes it to the theaters?
Well, and this is why when you guys discuss this on the Geek Buddies, I always am just like, I can list 30 movies where that happened and it was terrible, and I can list 30 movies where that happened and it was great. There's just no knowing what the fuck is going on. I mean, think of all the stories we've told of all the insanity going on in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, that's what making movies is like.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
But needless to say, they didn't have those test screenings. Apparently, they didn't need it because it was Warner Brothers' highest grossing film in years. It made $300 million, which is a huge amount of money in 1978. It's the only reason it's not the number one movie of the year is because of a little movie called Star Wars, you know, which, you know, the biggest movie of all time at the time. As we've now discussed many times, the Salkinds did not invite Richard Donner back to complete his work on Superman 2. And there is a Richard Donner cut, which is, I think it's better-ish. I think they're both flawed movies, you know?
I think the setup of Superman 2, and we'll do this they'll save it for another day, but I think the setup of Superman 2 is great. And there's a bunch of great stuff. And then you get to the end of that movie on either cut, sort of peters out.
Yes, agreed. I would agree with that 100%.
Yeah. There is one more thing I think it's important to discuss before we wrap up. So the documentary about Christopher Reeve came out about 6 months ago, nine months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I avoided watching it. And I know I should have watched it. And I kept meaning to. And we got requests, John and I, to do a short on it. And we said we're going to do it. And then I didn't watch it. And it took me a long time to go like, oh, I think it's because my dad died of ALS. So I watched my dad become paralyzed and die. And so I think there was just kind of a little too close a thing for it for me. Sure. But then I knew that when we did the show, I really needed to watch it. It's a lovely documentary. It didn't actually wreck me the way that I thought it would. So I do think we need to talk about Christopher Reeve and what happened to him, which is that in 1995, his horse made a refusal on a fence jump, landed headfirst, and was paralyzed from the neck down. And it is just the fact, John, that you mentioned that Margot Kidder also became paralyzed, which I didn't know, is like...
Yeah, from the car accident.
I mean, it's just such a tragedy. And I think we all went through a lot seeing what he went through, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the truth is, and you can't sugarcoat it, right? I mean, there are, if you want to go back and look at, there are people who've talked about Christopher Reeve in the past before the accident, and he wasn't always the nicest guy. And, you know, working with him, and there was a lot of arrogance to him and the way he approached things. But Christopher himself said, like, you know, like, I changed a lot after that accident. I realized what it was like, ironically, for Superman to become mortal. And it changed him. You know, and so it is a horrible tragedy. But if you watch that movie, what he was able to turn it into after processing like all these feelings of like, how do I go on? Am I worth anything anymore? Like, it's such a great documentary because it explores that and then what he does with that. Just like the Michael J. Fox documentary, I think is fantastic as well to see what they do with these situations.
Well, I think. You know, I mean, Superman's my favorite hero, and we've all talked about it for years about how why I like Superman. But look, Superman is an unattainable ideal.
Sure.
None of us can ever be as good as Superman is because he's not real. But as we were saying earlier with the Lois Lane stuff in this movie, every Superman movie is about even Superman reaching a point where something happens that he can't overcome.
Mm.
And then he overcomes it. And for Christopher Reeve, the reason his story is so inspiring and the reason the documentary ultimately is more uplifting than depressing is because in his real life, Christopher Reeve had something happen that he could not overcome.
Yeah.
And in his way, he kind of overcame it.
Yep.
Not that he cured himself, but he had something happen that by any account, if you were like, I tapped out after that, I went and became a recluse and I lived the rest of my years in my apartment and had people come and take care of me. And you'd be like, yeah, you know what? I get it. But the fact that he went on to do so much and inspire so many, in his way, he kind of pulled a Superman. And I think that's what's amazing about his life and what's amazing about that documentary.
And I think about the last line of the movie. What does he say to him? It takes, we're all part of the same. What did he say to the warden?
Don't thank me. We're all part of the same team.
Right. And it took a team of people to help Christopher through this, to find his way, including his wife, including his friends and his family. So he, as you said, Michael, he served as an example of being Superman, not only by his actions to overcome this, but by working as a team with other people to help him overcome this and turn it into a place to use how to teach people about how to overcome these things, but also to raise money to help other people who are suffering through these kinds of things. And it's really amazing. And yeah, I hear you, Steve. I only cried once, and that was Robin Williams' Eulogy. I couldn't yeah. contain myself on that.
Well, that's just a double whammy,
right?
That's
the thing. And so, but the other stuff was, you're right, Steve, much more inspiring than sad. And so it is something to encourage people to see.
I love what both of you said. And I think that it's, there's just this terrible coincidental irony of Superman being paralyzed, you know, and there's so much that carries on with our image of Christopher Reeve in that suit and what he represented connected to then what happened to him. And I think there's this weird way. I think it does help us connect what the difference is between superhero heroism and the kind of heroism that us humans can do, you know, is that I think is really that he exemplifies.
But I also think that's what makes Superman so amazing, is that the original superhero, the very first superhero that gave birth to all other superheroes, who has every power, so many powers that like you're just like, sure, counterclockwise Earth, time travel, why not? But the thing that makes him the most super, the thing that makes him the most enduring, and the thing that makes him one of the most beloved superheroes, it's not the freeze breath, it's not the heat vision, it's not the flight, it's not the super strength, it's none of that. It's the stuff that any of us can do. Like, you can be kind. I hear it's the new punk rock. You know, you can be a good person. You can help people who need help.
Yeah.
And that's what makes Superman, Superman. And I think watching what Christopher Reeve did, to your point, I agree with everything you said, except I would say that like he exemplifies the best of all superheroes. It's not the difference between everyday heroes and superheroes. What Christopher Reeve actually did later in his life is the best of superheroes, because why we love all of these heroes has their powers are great. That's the icing. The powers are amazing. What they can do is cool. Show me the good special effects. But what makes these heroes heroic is something that any single one of us can emulate.
John.
Yes.
What are your final thoughts?
Here's my final thoughts. The movie is still incredible. I still love it to pieces. Yes, I know now looking back in 2025 that there are things to pick out or have issues with or have a fun poking fun at. But the spirit and the heart of the movie is what always brings me back to the movie, and the wonder and the joy that courses throughout this movie, you know, and from the opening beats there on Krypton and seeing the incredible costumes and what happens and the fact that they didn't listen to someone who knew what was going to happen, to Clark landing there, to the young Clark in high school, what happens with his father, which devastates all of us, the way he changes, that scene with his mom, and then boom, out into the real world, and the adult world, and these interactions with Lois that really add this human element to Superman that is so essential for us to enjoy, which is the relationship with Lois Lane, just like the relationship with his dad and just like the relationship with his mom. The human elements of Superman throughout the movie are what really bring me back. The powers are great. The flying is great. Saving cats are great. Stopping dams are great. But it's his relationship with the human beings that we want to aspire to and we want to believe in. And that's what brings me back every single time. And that film accomplishes it over and over and over again every single time I watch it. So it was great to watch it again for this and to talk about it with you guys and hear all your perspectives on these numerous scenes throughout the movie. So yeah, love this film. Still holds up. It is the best Superman film still. no matter what my love of Man of Steel is, this is inarguably, in my opinion, the best of them. And there are many reasons why.
Mr. Vogel, what are your final thoughts on this film?
My final thoughts are, I love this movie. Despite all the things that I think are silly about this movie, I love this movie. I will always love this movie. I also completely understand why people who come to this movie later in life, particularly in the superhero era of cinema that we live in now, why I get why they think it's silly. But I think what makes this movie enduring and what makes this movie the quintessential Superman movie is it gets back to that point that Steve hates bringing up, which is, did a superhero movie, quote unquote, get it right or not? That we are all so obsessed with. We are obsessed with, did Man of Steel get Superman right? Did James Gunn's Superman get Superman right? And I think the reason that this movie still stands out and what kind of kept coming up as we've been discussing all these things is it's not that this movie got Superman right more than any other movie. It's that this movie wrote the book on Superman in a bunch of ways that we still come back to today. Mm. Like, they didn't get Krypton right. They defined Krypton. Mm. They didn't get Clark Kent being a mild-mannered reporter right. Like, they defined that klutzy Clark Kent. They defined Lois Lane and the fact that she can't spell. Like, there's so many elements that you see here that have just become definitive. And so I think that's really what makes this thing the one to beat, is that it inspired every piece of Superman content moving forward. Like, you look at any of the Superman comics that happened from 1978 to 2025. You look at Lois and Clark. You look at Smallville. You look at Superman and Lois on the CW. You look at Superman the Animated Series. You look at My Adventures with Superman. You can just go down the list. And even the fact that when Bryan Singer made Superman Returns, nobody's top Superman movie, but he went to Richard Donner and said, can I basically do an homage to you? It's why Kevin Spacey's wearing a bunch of wigs. And even Zack Snyder and James Gunn, for as different as those movies both are, still pull a lot. I mean, you talk about Mrs. Tessmacher being on the arm of a villain and then being the one that turns at the end and ends up helping save the day. That applies to both movies. So I just think that this movie isn't the one that got it the most right. It's the one that wrote the book, the rule book, in a lot of ways. And I think that's really, really amazing.
It's great points. So I mean, there's so many things to say about this movie. We talked a lot about the complexity of the production, bringing in Brando and Hackman and how that messed things up, the search for the person to play Superman and Christopher Reeve's great performance and the technology of the flying and all that stuff. And we've even talked about sort of, you know, some of the things that I find the movie a bit slow and stuff like that. But that's not what I want to talk about. I want to specifically talk about one thing thematically, which is something that we've discussed over and over again on the podcast since the very beginning, is the idea of the myth of America and the myth of being good. And there's, like, when we did, whether it was Apollo 13 and The Right Stuff, or whether there are all sorts of movies where particularly, or Dr. Strangelove, where since the Kennedy assassination and the 60s and Watergate in Vietnam, we have gone, we can't believe in stuff anymore. Mm. And anything comes too sincere or too honest, we go, people aren't really like that. People aren't that good. People are complicated. The world is complicated. You can't trust anybody, et cetera. And as a person who can be very cynical, I agree with most of those points. There were things that we were delusional about when we were putting forth these myths of America and these myths of truth and justice. But I really think, and this is the joy of this movie, and I think James Gunn's Superman 2 is, like, we need to keep those myths alive. Yes, we can acknowledge that Superman is not a realistic character. We can acknowledge that. But keeping the myths alive allows us to believe that humans can be better. And when you only believe that humans are terrible, then they are terrible. But if you believe that they can be better, then we can strive to be a little less terrible. And I think it's so important. And so, this was the big epiphany that I had when doing this show with you, is that in 1938, when Superman was introduced, things were really shitty. It was right at the end of the Depression. And in 1978, when this movie came out, it was right after all those things that had ruined the myth of America. And here we are in that moment again, where people don't believe, they don't think it's possible for America to succeed, for the world to succeed, for people to work together, for us to be part of a team, for people to make sacrifices and do all those things that are necessary to build a society. And the thing that we need is, we need to believe in a little bit of those myths. And that's what was great revisiting this movie for me, is that it helped me believe just a little bit more. So that's what we think of Superman. Of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. You can follow us on Twitter at @Cine_Files, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or YouTube or anywhere else, and leave your reviews on Apple Podcasts. They're very, very helpful. So if you haven't left a review on Apple Podcasts, please do so. You can buy or stream Superman along with every other film we've ever done on cinephiles.net. And you can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how would folks reach you?
You can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky, and Threads. And of course, my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays, where you see all the great content I've got there with my reactions and my reviews, but also all the shows like The Hot Mic, The Jedi Way, Spill the Tequila, my new show called The Truth, and of course, The Geek Buddies with our guest, Michael Vogel and Shannon McClung.
And speaking of Michael Vogel, would you like people to follow you on the interwebs?
I love being followed. You can do so on Twitter and Instagram at MKToon. You can also see me every week, usually multiple times, on John Roca's YouTube channel, where we co-host The Geek Buddies with Shannon McClung. And you know, my phone number is probably written on public restrooms throughout the greater West Hollywood area. Oh, so go look for them there, and I'll hear from you soon.
You're going to get some interesting contacts, I think. John, are you cool with me announcing what's coming next?
Oh, yeah, we should announce it. Our summer of redos continues. Steve, what have we got?
So after much debate, it is the 50th anniversary of Jaws. We went back and forth. We discussed it on a live show. We discussed it with our advisory board. And we have decided, yes, we are redoing Jaws. We're just because this was so much fun, going in so much detail about this film, and Jaws is one of the greatest films ever made. And so we are re-entering the world of Amity Island next week on The Cinephiles.